He's never admitted guilt yet either. Well, the story opens up where we left off in a very different place. We started looking first at the bottom of the Rhine River, and we had those very innocent, happy, trusting Rhine maidens. And then we went up into heaven, so to speak, and we saw the duplicitous gods trying to have security. I guess duplicitous people always try to get security. And they had just made a bad deal, only they could redeem the deal. They could redeem love by getting the gold from Alberich and giving the gold to the giants. And so the next scene opens up in what is called Nibelheim, the home of the Nibelungs. Remember that Alberich was a Nibelung, and it is a dark, cave-like world, away from any light of the world, and it has an eerie light, and it's filled with smoke. And everywhere there are the sounds of industry. There are Nibelungs that are mining, and there are Nibelungs that are forging, and there are Nibelungs that are fabricating and such like that. However, their fabrications are different than Logis or Loki's. And what happens is Mima, who is a dwarf, that is a relative of Alberich, is just putting the finishing touches on a thing that he has made, that Alberich has designed and commissioned for him to make and taught him how to make. And all of the while that he's making this object, he is scheming on how he's going to steal it and have it for himself. And that when he has it for himself, he's going to be free of all of the brutality of Alberich, because Alberich, he has become, having forsworn love, he has become mean and cruel, and he's been a hard taskmaster, and he pushes and pushes and pushes. And so a new sin has entered in, the sin of thievery, that once somebody cares for something or loves something or identifies self relative to external objects, that brings in the whole concept of possession. And I don't really know if there is such a thing as possession, if you know what I mean, that somebody owns something. Other than our bodies, which are direct expressions of ourselves, I think I would agree with the American Indians that we really don't possess anything. We just use them. We just use things. You see, if anywhere in the universe, on any plane, any position, any planet, any star, a lie is still a lie. But a possession isn't at any time in any place likely to be owned by someone. And this is the kind of thinking that has now gotten into the Nibelungs. The item that Mima is building is an old friend of ours that goes back to the story of Perseus. The symbols, again, are universal to all myths. And the thing that he is building is a Tarnhelm. And this Tarnhelm is such that whoever wears it, by taking thought, can look like whatever he or she wishes to look like. And the big thing about it is that it is very appealing to Mima, is that by wearing the Tarnhelm, he can wish himself invisible. Now that's a really interesting concept, because invisibility is a two-way street. Because we often think of the invisible worlds and we think of how wonderful it would be to see the fairies and to see the gods and all of those sorts of things. And those worlds are visible merely because we have not made ourselves insensitive to them, that we can't see them. And we've made them that way by exiling ourselves, coming deeply into matter. But if we really take thought about the whole thing, we are also invisible to the gods. This is the whole thing, the story that is the story of Adam and Eve. When their eyes were opened, they saw they were naked. They were the first beings among our humanity, as we know our humanity, to have waking, self-conscious perception of the completely external world. And they're the first people to see the physical bodies. And relative to the kind of consciousness that everyone was used to having, the soul perception, like the gods have, where you can see a person's soul nature, all their thoughts and all of their feelings, their desires, what they're going to become, at least in those internal things, this is a very limited world. And so the thing is the gods don't have sense organs in this world. So literally, in this physical body, and if we put ourselves completely in brain thinking, without letting any of it come through, we're invisible to the gods. So it's a two-way street. And the motivations are dual also. The motivations of the gods are motivations to be invisible, to be not interfering. You should be able to, if you're invisible, be able to view things or be able to view the causes of things in such a way that you don't have to interfere with what somebody else is doing. Truly, spiritual vision is what the physicists dream of when they think of the problems of the uncertainty principle, that the process that is used for measuring things gets in the way of the thing that you're measuring and affects it so that it changes it. But if one has the ability to transcend to a higher level, one can see the causes and one can see the ultimate consequences without participating in the deeds and the destiny itself. Now, Mima's motivation is of the other pole of motivation. He wants to hide. He wants to escape. And that's the way a lot of people take heaven by storm, is they try to escape the experiences on this world. They intoxicate themselves so that they're insensitive to this world, and they have a distorted, because they're fearful and because they don't have the integrity to face the inner world straightforward, they get a very distorted view of the inner world. At any rate, Loj and Wotan come into this underworld, and it's a really terrible place to them after being at the sublime heights of things. And Loj begins to get the confidence of Mima, and he congratulates him on his success even before his success. It's sort of like when you have insecure people, the way that you can flatter them the most is to play on their hopes. Because in the same way that we were talking a few weeks ago, that just desiring something, we already put a possession on it, and we get angry if somebody else takes the thing we desire. In the same way, in our insecurity, we identify our being into the future with what we dream to be and what we dream to become. And so what happens is Loj begins to play on Mima and get his confidence, and by saying, well, you know, it's going to be great when you have that. And then he also starts playing on his grumbling about Albrecht. And they get the whole secret of what the Tarnhelm is, which we have talked about before, that the Tarnhelm represents the power of suggestion. It represents a hypnotic-like power that one can suggest to others a form that is not the true nature. We've seen this in several ways. We've seen it when Perseus wore the Tarnhelm and freed himself from the sisters of Medusa, who would have come after him and killed him. But we've seen the same principle in another way. All of the river spirits that the various heroes have grabbed onto and had to hold onto when they turned into fire and every other conceivable thing, those were also suggestions, or those were effects of something and not the real cause and not the real source of them. Now, what happens is Albrecht starts to come back, and just before that, Mima is, because he didn't create and design the Tarnhelm, he really can't wear it. This is a principle in spiritual things, that unless you can create something, and unless it is an expression of you, you can't actually live in it. There are people that would like to believe that if they had a much more sensitive body, that they would be very developed spiritual people. Or there are people who would believe that if they had a very sensitive violin, like a Guanari, Amati or a Guanari, or something like that, that they would be excellent musicians. But only somebody who has developed the sensitivity can really use an instrument like that. And Mima doesn't understand that in order to really be able to possess the Tarnhelm, he has to have been able to create it. And then Albrecht comes back onto the scene, and he's driving all of the other workmen harder and harder and harder, because he is greedy for more and more gold, because he literally believes that the more gold that he has, the more power he's going to have. We've talked a little bit about that, that gold represents the ability to make spiritual energy manifest in the material world. And the belief is here that once one has a corner on the material world, and the kind of consciousness that we have in this world, which is in a way a consciousness that cannot even be interfered with by the gods, that this single purpose objectivity, if we can put our consciousness into that and be unbending about it, we have a kind of objectivity that's untouchable by any creature in heaven and earth. And this is what his desire is, only it's hard telling in all of this whether Albrecht is more free or whether he's more enslaved. Because once one is that much into desire, one then becomes the slave of the desires. And one of the first attributes of freedom is choice. And if you no longer have the freedom to choose, if desire automatically makes a choice, your choices for you in life, if there's a choice between wealth and the opportunity to do something beneficial to people, and you're locked into the greed for wealth, you don't even consider the other opportunity. You don't even know that the other opportunities are there. And once one then becomes a slave of desire, which gets attached to thing after thing after thing that it wants for itself, one is more enslaved than free. Loj then begins to work on Albrecht. And he works several ploys on him. He calls to remembrance the times that he has helped Albrecht, and he plays on the wealth of Albrecht, saying how powerful he is. Albrecht, because he's still that same insecure little dwarf that represents the early stage of humanity, because he's that insecure, he projects the compliments as envy. He projects his own insecurity, and he thinks to himself that the gods are envious of him and that they're weak. And then Loge begins to continue to work on him, and Albrecht starts talking, and he begins to brag. The more Loge works on him and compliments him for what he has done, the more he begins to brag about the wealth of his gold. And already, once you're bragging and making something untrue or unnecessary, you see, vanity is always unnecessary. If he had just mined all of that gold and made all of the power that he could out of the gold, that would have been all right. But if he has to talk about it and brag about it, that's unnecessary. So when you do that, when you do something unnecessary, you're leaving large gaps and your accomplishments aren't real accomplishments. Or only you partially lose them or temporarily lose them. Because clearly, if he is doing all of this work, if he is mastering the world, and if he is mastering the highest element of the world, gold, which represents the transition from the physical to the inner worlds, truly he has, in spite of all of his selfishness, developed some soul power. But in his insecurity and in his vanity, he still doesn't know that. You know, this is what is true of all of us, that we're going through all kinds of experiences that we're being led into by base motivations, and we're working very hard, and we're getting good things out of them. You know, like if you think about a robber who is casing a joint, he's practicing observation, and in some ways he may be practicing observation and discrimination much more astutely than a spiritual student, because, you know, his life in or out of prison may depend on how well he's doing. And so there is a gathering of gold by Albrecht, even though he doesn't know that he has it or doesn't know what he has there, all in all. As things go, Loge keeps leading him on, and he keeps bragging more and more and more, and pretty soon he impudently starts saying, "I have my designs on Valhalla, your castle, which is impregnable to anything, supposedly, is eventually going to be mine. Because with this gold, either by bribery or by the power that's within the gold itself, I'm going to be able to get Valhalla for myself." And having made this great big braggadocious claim, Loge has him just where he wants him. And he says the old thing that is always the bane for bullshitters. He says, "Put up or shut up." He tells him, show me what you can do. And then he says, yeah, and so what happens is Albrecht takes the Tarnhelm away from Mima, and he puts it on his head, and he becomes a huge, big serpent. And at that, Wotan and Loge, Wotan taking the cue from Loge, both shrink in terror, continuing the setup of the whole thing, and they've got him now thoroughly hooked. And then he turns back into himself as Albrecht again to laugh at all of his powers and how he already has the gods quivering at him. And then the moment is there. And Loge says, all right, I can see how you can be something very big. How can you be something little insignificant like a toad? And Albrecht falls for it, and he turns himself into a toad. And immediately, Loge has his foot on him, and he's caught. And Wotan rips the helmet off of him, and they hold him, and they bind him up. And that's the end of that scene. When you've got to prove something, any time a person has to prove or demonstrate their spiritual powers, that is automatically an act of vanity. That is automatically a place where one is just begging and crying for a downfall. Anybody who is truly spiritual rests in the divine and rests in a confidence in self. Phenomena come, but phenomena come only as a consequence of some fruitful purpose. Like no energies are wasted, especially the spiritual energies which are required to do such spectacular phenomena. And you know you're going to be lost as soon as you start doing that stuff. And that is exactly what has led to the downfall of Albrecht. And that's the end of that scene. The scene, well, I went ahead of my notes here. Oh, we're going to be really short tonight. My golly, because I'm not quite ready with all the Valkyries yet, so we'll be short. Maybe as little as an hour. The scene, the final scene of this opera, returns to the mountaintop right outside of Valhalla, which you see on the adjacent crag way at the top of the mountains. And at the opening of the scene, the gods are gathered as they were before when the giants took Freya away with her golden apples and everything turned gray and dismal. And usually this is portrayed on a stage because you're looking through a very gossamer screen or a very gossamer veil, and everything looks dimmed, and this is supposed to indicate the weakness and darkness of the gods in the inner worlds without the apples of love. What happens is the scene opens with Wotan and Loge coming out of the cleft in the rock that they used to go way, way down into Niflheim, and they're carrying the bound Albrecht with them. And what happens is this, you know, the whole notion here is a notion that applies to such little things as running stoplights. If you run a stoplight, you have to hold your desire body in unless you want immediate justice or destiny. I'm not talking about an intentional thing, but occasionally sometimes people do not have their mind on what they're doing. And if you don't have your mind on what you're doing, sometimes you go through a stop sign, and if a cop is there, you can telegraph to that cop. You know what I'm saying? By your panic or by your fear, he will notice. There are a lot of things in life that if you don't exaggerate your feelings or if you don't take alarm at them, they will not be noticed. This is a very cunning kind of thing, but the principle is there. What happened is, with Albrecht, is he made a big deal of his desire. He made a big deal about everything he was doing. And when you make a big deal of what you're doing, that attracts attention. There's always a lodge around to be following the whole proceedings of the world and to know exactly what's going on everywhere. And if you make a big deal about things, especially with your desire, you know, this is again a philosophy of chess playing. Unless you are a very, very powerful player, sometimes if you're setting up a trap for someone, you try to not telegraph what your thoughts are for the other person. You want them to inadvertently fall into that. You don't want to telegraph. Ultimately, if you become the consummate chess player and you're confident in yourself, you don't have to. You can deliberately say what you're doing. And when you get to really good chess players, they each know what the other is doing, and they try to do something better beyond what the other person is doing, which is, I think, a much better way of life. But Lodge has called attention. This happens for positive and for negative, in the same way that if we put too much hoopla on our activities and brag about what we're doing and things like that, we not only attract other people that want the things that we want, but in positive, it is a wonderful thing that can provide for our security. That we don't have to worry about whether what we're doing will gain notice or not. We don't have to go to all of that trouble and all of that offensive activity that goes into advertising. Because if what we're doing is really worthwhile, and if it is really something that is beneficial for humanity, if it is something that people really want in their heart of hearts, they'll be drawn to that as well. And so it's a very interesting principle. And another principle that is in the principle of Albrecht's downfall is that in all of his schemings, just like in all of the schemings of Loki, Lodge for Wotan, all of those schemings come to naught. It's like the book of Revelation says, the wise shall be captured in their folly. That if you put all of your time into machinations, scheming about how you're going to, scheming about what you're going to do and how powerful you're going to be and all of that, this is exactly what Albrecht does when they command him. Wotan commands him. He says, all right, I want the gold, and I want it here right now. And very surreptitiously, Albrecht touches the ring, and he starts yelling out commands, and pretty soon Nibelungs are coming from all over the place, and they start piling up all of the gold. And what is happening is, all the while, Albrecht is scheming and he's telegraphing the thought that I'm going to keep the ring. Let's see if I can even find the words here where he goes, he says, yes, yet if I can only keep the ring, I can easily do without the treasure. And he says, you know, he reckons he'll be able to get it all back on again. And all of the treasure gets piled up. And the Tarnhelm gets thrown on, Tarnhelm doesn't immediately get thrown on the pile of gold. And then Wotan asks him, give me the ring. I want all of the gold. And Albrecht says, how does he say it? Take my life, but not the ring. take my life, but not the ring. This is a very, very deep principle. I don't even know if I'm capable at this time to go into it. But once we have forged the ring of separative selfhood, that becomes our definition for the entire cosmos. And when we have that definition, there is inherent in that a selfishness, a self-conception, a self-conceit. That is extremely important because it is what gives us our point of view that we have to offer to the gods and that we have for a self-identity. But as long as we cling to that view, we cannot ultimately appreciate it. This, again, is another facet of the problem of self. It is only when we give up the self and that we give it up out of love, the very love that was forsworn in order to develop the ring in the first place, only at such a time can we really garner the real meaning of it. Because if you think about it, as long as you're within the ring, you're penned in the same way that Wotan would be penned in Valhalla. You would be impregnable, and you would have yourself, which no one could take away from you. And yourself, though it may extend to the entire ends of the universe, is still bounded by the ring. And in order to have freedom, in order to have the higher view of the ring, you have to step outside of the ring. That is to say, when you give up the ring, the objectivity of the ring is not lost, but then you see it from the viewpoint. It is transferred to the universal spirit that belongs to everyone, and the objectivity is maintained, and all of the selfishness and the subjectiveness and all of the small-mindedness is what is lost. It's very necessary for us now to develop a self and to develop that self as extensively as we can so that it really reaches to the full extent of the cosmos. But somewhere along the line, we have to be able to make the transition from looking at things from the viewpoint of self to looking at the viewpoint of others. And this is the whole Christian ideal, that even in the simplest sense, in the most orthodox Christianity, when one gives one's life over to Christ, one is in fact leaving the domain of egocentric orientation to orientation by looking at it in the way that other people would look at it, and that becomes a really totally different outlook. It's like saying you've gained the whole universe, you know, and you don't have to worry. Yourself is still there. You know what I'm trying to say? It's still a universal, it's still an immortal thing that you have created. Wotan takes the ring and puts it on. And immediately, as soon as Wotan puts it on, he becomes subjected to it. Now, this is a really big thing again. Somehow I get onto these tasks in such little bitty things that I don't know how to deal with them. But our introduction of sinful selfishness, our introduction of separative selfhood, which was never intended in the first place, in effect gets given to the gods. Now, most of the divinities that have, or almost all of the divinities that have participated in our creation, have been much more cooperative with the divine plan. Even though there was individuation, there was never separative individuation. And this is a really big thing. Anything that is done by any being, any creature in the cosmos, affects every other being, every other creature in the cosmos. And when we took on the conception of separative selfhood involved with materialism and possession and single-pointedness and all of those things that came from our, that are now what are the totality of our consciousness, we transplanted that onto the gods. They aren't quite, because they never themselves sinned, and because they never themselves became completely disobedient, it isn't as if they have the same kind of objectivity that we have, or the same kind of insecure separation that we have, but they have the effects of it. Because literally, when we take our experience day by day and give that over to the gods, whether we give it over every day or whether we give it over at the end of our lives, that is food for the gods, not only in experience, but in that very special kind of experience. So Wotan putting on the ring and taking on some of the characteristics of Alberich in the inclinations toward selfishness is a really big statement in the story that we're telling, because what we have done, you know, in a way, the people who say the gods or God is a creation of humans, they make that as an atheistic statement, and they say that our conceptions of God are as high as our conceptions of ourself or our abilities to conceive in ourself. Those people are not ultimately right, but there is a grain of truth in that our conceptions about the nature of the divinities or of the divine or of the principles, especially as we see it working in this world, affects those things, and it brings them to a greater self-understanding that they wouldn't have any other way. My goodness, this is all very little storytelling tonight, all rambling. But I've been extremely conscientious this week in almost everything I've done. At work, I've been working very hard, and I've been working hard on my studies and doing reasonably well on my retrospection. And as a consequence, I get interested and excited about all of the biggies. What happens is that the ring is taken away from Alberich, Alberich does something that is very common to humans, and it's another kind of inversion. Everything that comes into being through the Word. And Alberich now has some of that creative power, and he uses it in the most venomous way possible, because his stamp is on that ring, his being is on that ring, and when it is taken from him, he pronounces a curse on it. Its gold gave me unmeasured power, now its magic shall breed death for him who wears it. No joyful man shall have joy of it, oh, no happy man shall its bright gleam smile. Care shall consume whoever possesses it, and whoever possesses it not, envy shall gnaw. All shall lust after its possession, but none shall delight in its use. Its lord shall guard it without profit, and yet shall attract his destroyer to him. Predestined to die, let fear fetter the craven while he lives. Let the Lord of the Ring waste away as the slave of the ring. The curse goes on. Wagner is not small about his use of words, being very Gemini, Sun and Ascendant both. He pronounced the real curse. His curses are almost as good as Shakespeare's curses are. But it is the ultimate. You see, the first sin was the sin of using sex for pleasure. It was the selfish turning of the creative energy downward and outward for sensory pleasure and to perpetuate selfishly a life in the material world. The sin against the Holy Spirit in the New Testament, if you look at it, in the Matthew's Gospel, Christ is very clear in that the sin against the Holy Spirit is lying. It's said literally so. And a curse is a very special kind of lie. It's a lie against the ultimate power of love. And what this does is produces, it's a very spiteful thing. It's a triple cross. What happens everybody gets hurt by what he does, but it ultimately will turn out for everything for the positive. We should get on with the story, otherwise this will end up being long. The giants at this point come back and they bring Freya with them, and they say, here is Freya, you can have her back if we can have all of the gold. And so Freya gets set there, and they start stacking up the gold around her. And at first, Wotan holds back the Tarnhelm. And one of the giants says, I can still see the glint of her hair, is what he says. And it's beautiful how the poetry works into that. Because as we've seen before, the hair is like an offal, an excrement from the physical body. But the hair has always, especially golden hair, in fact, there's even a constellation in the heavens called the Coma Berenices. And in every mystery school, and even most primitive pagan mysteries, locks of golden hair are part of the celebration, even if it's just a reference to it. And what they're talking about here is the soul body. What they're talking about is the ability to be invisible, as Apollonius of Tyana used to be invisible. He did it right in the court of Rome. When the emperor was saying to him, this is what I'm going to do to you. I'm going to do this and this and this. And Apollonius of Tyana says, you're going to do nothing to me. And he takes his robe and puts it around himself, and suddenly he's invisible. This is a historical event recorded by several historians of the time. And this means that, in effect, that he was affecting the ethers, and he was doing that through his soul body. And the ability to make oneself invisible is what the Tarnhelm represents. And when the giant says, I can still see your hair, what he's saying is, he's saying that power is missing. And Wotan begrudgingly throws the Tarnhelm into the pile. And then one of the other giants says, what does he say here? Alas, her eye still flashes on me. The pupil of her eye still beams on me. Must I espy it through a chink? And that is also very significant, that spiritually speaking, the pupil of the eye belongs more to the person possessing the body than it belongs to that person and that person only. If the body is possessed, the use of the eye, the control of the pupil of the eye, can never be taken away if somebody else overtakes the body. And what is the eye? The I in this case is the same as the other I. There it is, the symbol of the sun, the symbol of the self. And so the ring is, in a very, very clever and beautifully poetic way, the ring is put together with the identity of selfhood and the occult fact of the eye being associated with the chink, that he can still see the pupil of the eye. And here is what happens at that point. Wotan says, "What are you prattling about? That which I captured for myself with such difficulty, I will fearlessly keep for myself." In another place he says, "Boldly demand what you will, I would grant anything, but not even for the whole world will I give up the ring." So he doesn't want to give up the ring. He's immediately contaminated by the selfishness. And nobody can cajole him into giving up the ring. And everything of heaven and earth is at stake here. Because if the gods give themselves over to the human ways, the ways of selfishness, this is going to mean the downfall of the whole cosmos. In the same way that people are worried, and rightly so, that we might be destroying all of nature such that continuance on this plane will be impossible as a result of environmental destruction, either by atomic energy or by everything being contaminated with poisons. What's involved here is the whole universe is at stake if the creative beings get locked. So when Wotan is on the verge of becoming selfish in the same way that humans are selfish, everything is at stake. What happens is, at this point, Erda comes rising out of the earth. And she only appears from the waist up. She comes out of a crack of the earth. And Erda is Mother Earth, and she is the prophet who knows just about everything. Now let's see if I can find her proclamation here. Oh yes. "Who are you, woman, who exhorts me?" She said, the first thing she says, "Yield, Wotan, yield, fly from the ring's curse. Utter ruin past salvation, its gain will bring you." And Wotan says, "Who are you, woman, who exhorts me?" And she says, "I know how all once was, how all is, and how all will be. I can see besides the primeval one of the everlasting world. All-wise Erda gives warning to your spirit. 3 daughters primevally created, my womb has borne. What I see, the Norns tell you nightly. The gravest danger drives me here to you today myself. Take heed, all that has an end. A doom-laden day is dawning for the gods. I counsel you, shun the ring." In the talking about the primal spirit, Erda represents the divine feminine as it is inverted in matter. And therefore it represents some very primal, primary, instinctive kind of wisdom. But even more than that, it represents the feminine connection with the absolute, the source of all creation that is untouched and uncontaminated by creation. And it represents the feminine source of all. The manifest being of spirit is always masculine. And it asserts itself to produce the creation. But when it's on the point of asserting and expressing itself so far to the point that it would mean downfall by overstretching itself, and if the universal spirit were to overstretch itself, that very delicate balance between collapse and creation would be broken and everything would come to naught. And so at this point, there is something that is even like a para-intuition for Wotan, the chief of the gods, in that he draws on this understanding from the absolute that he is at his end, and this is the way it goes when you're at your very, very end, that you have nothing left. You have to rely at that point, when you're at the bottom of your well, you have to then rely on something that's beyond yourself, even though it may be something unknown and unknowable. And Erda, who expresses herself through the three Norns, remember the hags that we had when we talked about east of the sun and the west of the moon, and each of them had the knowledge of one stage of the quest for knowledge, and we said that the old hags represented the divine in the feminine state, in the aged state, in that they were primeval, and that they were feminine in that they were receptive and not assertive as the spirit was. And so this is incidentally, the Norns have names that are associated with the past, the present, and the future. Verdande, for example, means what will be. Our word will become, or something like that, is like contained in her name. But Wotan, at this point, sees the light and he accepts prophecy of Erda, and he gives up the ring. This indicates that he was never too, the gods were never really too contaminated by it, but enough so that there had to be eventually a destruction of the world of the gods, which brings this all to another level higher, meaning to say that because the cosmos is created and because it has a character of the Creator, that the Supreme Being created this, it must itself dissolve. And it must be all given over to the infinite feminine of the absolute, the unknowable. And what Wagner is hinting at here is that this whole very petty cycle, even as grand as we've been trying to look at it, is small compared to the notion that the whole concept of the self, of the cosmos, the individuation of the cosmos within non-being, is subject to the same principle, only it's much less of a debacle for that than for us. When he gives it up, love is regained. That is to say, Freya is regained. And the love comes back to the gods, and they see things in a different light. Let's look at something a little bit that the giants say, because as soon as the ring goes to the giants, the curse has its effect on them. They start fighting for the ring. And Fafnir says to Fasalt, who grabs the ring, he says, "Back, you churl, the ring is mine. Let it remain with me in place of Freya's eyes." Fafnir says to him, "Take your hands off, the ring is mine. I hold it, it belongs to me." And what happens is Fafnir gives a death blow to Fasalt and kills him outright with one blow. The word in German is Totenschlag. Yeah, it's a death blow. And He even talks about the ring being red, the red gold, because the way he's seeing it is the gold of desire. Because what they have done is they have traded love for desire. They've made the same mistake that Albrecht has made. And as a result, if you take lust for the ring, here the ring means something different. It means then the ring of the creative energy, which is also the specialization of spirit. If one can take the incoming energy from the cosmos as it comes in through the cranium and goes down the spine, and then contain that and keep it within so that there is a full cycle with none of it being lost, then one has the creative power. But that creative power is associated with all of the desire of sexuality, so it is a quality of passion. The passion is all right if it is a passion for sacrifice. If it is a passion for creative giving, it's all right, because then the surplus of it is what goes out into the cosmos. But if one tries to hold that energy for self, for power, in order to overpower other beings or to be content in self, then that ring of creative energy is what produces the darkest black magicians of all kinds. And this is what happens. The first sin immediately leads to the second sin. The sin of Adam and Eve was the expression of the sexuality, but in this case, it is the holding selfishly of the lust for power. And the first sin leads to the second sin, which in the Old Testament was the sin of Cain, and that was the sin of murder. And it's now already happened with Fafner. And then the gods can celebrate. And this is what Loge says about it all. This is really beautiful, because as much as Loge has been described as this ultimate schemer, behind it all there really is a wisdom. And Loge says, "What indeed can compare with your luck, Wotan? Winning the ring won you much," meaning Valhalla. "That it is now taken from you profits you still more. See your enemies kill each other on account of the gold you have given away." Exactly the thing that we were talking about earlier. There's profound spiritual wisdom in here, that by taking on the ring of selfhood, and to some extent living for ourselves, living for number one, and taking care of ourselves, it has brought us, and it continues to bring us, this wonderful treasure. But when we give it up, and when we freely give it up, then we win the treasure of heaven. And the poetry that's in here, if it's something worthwhile, just sitting down with all the libretti and reading them and just pondering on what the words say and what they imply. Because I myself, I like reading pretty words. I like literature. But I love reading initiates, because I am an individual that is very gullible. And in my gullibility, I give myself to whatever I do. And there are very few things that I can read at all that I can give myself totally and know that I'm in the hands of someone that is truthful. You know what I mean? Some people have the whole idea that you've got to distrust everybody, because everybody has a corner where they're trying to get you for something. And somehow, when there are initiates, great people like Plato and Pythagoras, there are people that you can trust because their whole life was founded on truth. And even if they made errors, those errors were innocent errors and not errors that tended towards something grossly selfish. And for me, it is such a relief to be able to, because I've been harmed by things that I've read and followed. It's such a relief to find somebody who is an initiate that you can read and that you can give yourself to And when you give yourself to it, the more you can give to yourself to it, the more you can get out of it. And so I love reading that kind of poetry. But at any rate, the gods decide to celebrate. And what happens is this is still a world that is not the deepest of spiritual world, but Donner slams his hammer, there's thunder, and then lightning follows. And this is right in the instructions, and this is the stage instructions. And this is to show that in this world, the lightning comes first and then the thunder. In the spiritual world, it's the other way around. The sound of the word comes first and then the light. And so everything is inverted. And so the stage instructions here would show a flash of lightning followed by Donner's thunder, show a very important spiritual principle. And it begins to rain. And here's where we'd like to have multimedia, because as it begins to rain, the drops fall in the puddles. And this is done with harps. And as the harps are being plucked, they're plucked in such a way that you can just see, you know how when the water ring, it makes rings, raindrops make rings in the water, and you can just see that as the rain begins to fall. And as the rain begins to fall, a rainbow bridge forms across to the opposite crag where Valhalla is. And this is the Norse and the Germanic mythology are based a lot on the etheric energy. They're a much more scientific, kind of mythology, because the etheric energy on the polarity, the pole is the Yggdrasil, the tree that has the eagle at the top and the serpents chewing at the roots, trying to upend it, and out on the branches there are goats eating the leaves, and the squirrel goes up and down with the impulses. And this represents a pole of positive and negative, just like in electricity. And when it gets charged by the lightning or when it gets charged by the sun, it puts off a whole rainbow. And that whole rainbow is the electromagnetic spectrum, all of the colors that we see, the seven colors of the rainbow. In fact, it's so true that the thunder maker, Thor or Donner, can't ever walk across the rainbow bridge. He always has to walk through the water in order to get to Asgard or Valhalla in Asgard, which means to say he has to be insulated or it would disrupt and break up the whole bridge. The rainbow bridge is the same sign as the sign that was given to Noah. So this rain that has started is, remember, this all started in the beginning at the bottom of the Rhine River, when all of the earth has hadn't reached the critical temperature of the condensation of water, and so the earth was still a fog yet. Now, through the actions of Albrecht, and through the consequences of that on the gods, a certain degree of objectivity has been reached in the consciousness, and that coincides with the cooling of the earth so that precipitation can take place. Precipitation, whether it is the precipitation of a liquid or the precipitation of a crystal out of a solution, is always the action of concrete thinking. Like the ancient Rosicrucian alchemists that used to study transmuting base metals to gold. They had for each of the actions of nature that they were using in their experiment, they related to some process inside of themselves. Like when you dissolve things in solution, that was like the principle of assimilation of things into your feelings, where you just surround yourself and take them into you, and they become part of you, they're in solution. Whereas the assertion of will was the firing process, you know, like you burn things to find out what their true nature is, and then their true colors show out. But the process of precipitating crystals especially, but the precipitation of rain is the same thing, was a product of concrete thinking which solidified and made things tangible. And so this is the passing of an age. This is the passing of an age from Atlantis into our time the time of the rainbow children, because there was no rainbow before. Now there was a rainbow, and so what happens is the gods walk across the rainbow bridge and enter the new heaven, and Alberich and the Nibelungs are now their descendants become the new children of Earth, and everything is changed, and this is the end of it all. And in the waters falling from the rain, you still hear the Rhine maidens singing the joys of gold, more gold, but their joys are still the innocent kind of gold, but the innocence is now all lost. And it's really going to be lost in the next opera, which is quite how would you say it? It's leeringly sensual and salacious and all of those sorts of things. And that's where we'll take up next time. We'll try to do the whole opera. I think I've got it in such a place that we can do it in one 90-minute talk. So next time we'll start with the Walküre, which is our times. And then finally we get to the hero Siegfried.